Hey everyone out there, of course, this is WebDM. I'm Pruitt and Jim, and today we are, as you can see, speaking with one Brennan Lee Mulligan of College Humor CEO fame and Dimension 20 DM extraordinaire. Still not medicine. It's still not medicine.
Thanks so much for having me, gang. I'm truly so excited to be here. That's right. It's not medicine. We have to, now that the vaccine is actually real, we now need to do the complimentary CEO being like, the vaccine is not laundry detergent. Please don't clean your clothes with
don't
this.
Don't waste it.
Please expensive. Don't waste it. There's such a limited supply of it.
Can I use my vaccine if it's been out of the fridge for more than 4 hours?
Yeah.
Or my clothes.
It didn't remove that stain very well.
No.
Very good.
But Brennan, just off the bat, I got a question for you. I love asking people who are like in the world of like acting and gaming, like when it comes to preparing for a role or preparing for your game, which do you think informs or betters the other?
This is an awesome question, and I feel like I think there's a few people that kind of have my similar track that have gone through it, but I think maybe not too many. Like a lot of the people that I play with on Dimension 20 are people who were already very accomplished sketch comedians and improvisers by the time they really picked up D&D as a hobby. And for me, I'm very much the photo negative of that, I've been playing Dungeons and Dragons since I was 10 years old. And when I say playing, I mean like all day Saturday and all day Sunday for years as an adolescent was playing D&D with two different groups of friends. I had so many friends that wanted to play that we needed to do like a Saturday group and a Sunday group so that we could rotate them all in. And then even with that, me and my brother were such huge, just fiends for the stuff. We had our entire room was, the whole shelf was just D&D box sets and paraphernalia. We had minis up on the wall and everything. Me and my brother, when we were like, 11 or 12 years old, would sit at the head and foot of one or the other's bed, mono campaign DMing for the other, like single PC campaign on the weeknights in between. So very, any of the like actor performance stuff, because I was an improviser at the Upright Citizens Brigade, obviously College Humor. I have the inverse of that, where all of that is extremely informed by D&D. That's kind of the nucleus, and then everything else, all the sort of satellite stuff came out from that.
I love this like solo gaming when you're younger, right? Because getting that many people together when you're 10 or 11 is just how does this happen? You have to have call parents. There's all kinds of things involved. So there was a lot of solo gaming, just me and one other person. So for me, it was like me and my best friend, and we just swap off who was running, the other. I don't think we used a single rule, even though we had rule books open, dice, all of that, right? Like, I cannot recall. This would have been Star Wars West End. I don't know how it works at all. I just know we rolled bucket loads of D6s and used our micro machines as miniatures. So there you go.
100%. But to your point, I don't like when I think back at being like a teenager, especially like being really adolescent, like how did anything happen? How did we ever hang out? You have those memories of like looking back at your life and you're like, oh yeah, the first date I ever went on as a teenager, my mom dropped me off. It was like, here you go like you're at the diner, I'll be back in 45. And this is like early days of even like teenagers having cell phones. It's very elder millennial vibe of like, what the hell was going on? I was flirting on AOL Instant Messenger, bizarre. And for D&D as well, that kind of like logistical, I have a lot of like nostalgia for diners, and people will sometimes be like, what's the deal with diners? And I was like, well, if you, there are certain places, especially like like New Paltz, High Falls area of New York, where it's like, oh, if you're not going to, like, that's where you have to hang out, unless you're hanging out in the dark forest at night. Those are your those are your spots to pick. But yeah, especially with like the D&D rule books as well. Yeah, I remember being 10 years old and just having the Player's Handbook, Monster Manual, and Dungeon Master's Guide and being like, incredible. Yeah. Under no circumstance will I be reading this, but no. It is my most treasured possession. You're 10 years old and you're like, cool, like different poison mechanics. Okay, God, I'm so hyped up on sugar and popcorn, just trying to focus to read this, you know, paragraph of text. Some sloppy mechanics in those first couple years.
Very much. A lot of reverse engineering from a table. You know, like this is what the table says. I'm just going to roll and see make it up. Yeah, see what happens. You know, kind of thing.
Because you guys, I'm sure everyone here has played second edition. Because like I came in second edition.
Same.
Yep. Yeah. Second edition here. Yeah. In the late 90s.
Yes.
When I first started, and so I mean, I remember my mom dropping me off for D&D one time. I mean, I was like 23, but you know.
Yeah.
At least she did tell me she was praying for me on the way home.
That's true. I started when I was 10 or 11, but it was with Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. And that was an outgrowth of the Fantasy Battles. And then it was Star Wars. And so I didn't start playing Dungeons and Dragons until 98, 99. Mm-hmm. But I had this sort of precursor where I was like, I was doing my own thing over there. And then I got into D&D and it was like, now I'm a D&D player.
but we had growing up, when we were playing second edition, we didn't have a diner we usually went to. We just went across the street from the movie theater we all worked at to Whataburger, which if you've been in the South, you know what Whataburger is. If you don't, you're missing it.
It's kind of a diner, sort of.
It's sort of a diner fast food.
24-hour greasy food.
Yeah, that's all you exactly want.
The spirit is there. The spirit's there.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a wild thing that I feel like that. Yeah, I started in 98. That was when I first picked up the game. And the idea of having a kid that young, again, like, you know, fifth grade or whatever, looking at Thaco, are you kidding? Like looking at a rule that Byzantine and draconian. It's a miracle that we played the game. I mean, like, I think by the time I was like 12 or 13, we were like 80 to 90% rules compliant, which that's a feat, man. If you're getting anywhere, you know, like pushing 60% of the rules are being used correctly, I feel like, you know, bravo to Tiny Brennan and company, you know, back in the day.
And that's a whole edition before feats were introduced too. So
yeah,
sure. Oh yeah, yeah. So D&D got its hooks in you pretty early, second edition even, which is a tough edition to start with. As Rob mentioned, were you a big like third edition fan when that came along, or were you
huge three, and then going into 3.5 was my edition. I am actually still playing a 3.5 campaign. I have, they're all 19th level. We've been playing for 11 and a half years.
Sweet.
You know, it's wild. It's great.
Why switch? Yeah.
Why switch? And also, especially because so many builds in 3.5 are so wacky and difficult. I can't do the port over to 5e when people have spent literally a decade plus waiting to capstone their insane characters. Like, I gotta let them
gotta let them do it. Come on. And by now it's retro, right? It's retro cool, like 3.5.
Exactly. Yeah. And who doesn't want to run encounters for players who have effectively broken the game from top to bottom? It's very much, I just got to the point now where again, 19th level 3.5 characters, it's like, I'll throw a challenge in front of them and be like, hey, I have bent all of my will to making this impossible. So this should be at least a round or two of fun.
Right. Hopefully it's a speed bump that we take a little bit of time to get over.
Yeah. Do you have a book limit on how many books you can use to build your character?
I have come in on some stuff. It's hard because you're like, your piecemeal rule. There were a couple of years there where we were still playing in person. We hadn't moved to playing virtually yet. And because we were playing in person, we only played like a couple times a year. So I was, you know, by the time I got there in person, I didn't want to take time out of a limited weekend of playing to like do bookkeeping. But when we moved to virtual, I actually get to spend like a little bit of time over the past year, especially during pandemic, like being like, wait a minute, what is this feat? And they'll be like, this is from page 17 of Zordaz's magazine of complete and utter gibberish. And I was like, we're going to rule that source out. We're not going to, you know, we knew enough to like block, you know, wiki homebrew stuff. But even with that, like with all respect to the designers of 3.5, there's some stuff where you like, I think the worst offenders, I don't know if you guys would share this for 3.5, the worst offenders to me are like, what is it? Book of Nine Swords and Exalted Deeds. Every once in a while, you got to go back in there and be like, what the hell is going on in here?
I had to be like, if we're using the Tome of Battle, Book of Nine Swords, then that replaces the rogue, that replaces the monk, that replaces the fighter. Like it, that's just the new martial classes.
Yeah.
And I liked it because it was like magical fighting styles. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you can't have like a war blade, whatever, next to a fighter and have it be even remotely apples to apples.
No, 100%. Yes.
Yeah.
We had an interesting thing in that campaign though, because we do a lot of homebrew. There's a lot of, and we also are very like story first play. It's very funny that I say story first, because all of my players will spend hours to days needling over the finest points of character optimization. Mm-hmm. That being said, it really is story first. You know, we'll do whole sessions where only a handful of dice get rolled, but there is something to that fact of like, I can't just X stuff out, because for example, the character that has that Book of Nine Swords stuff also has like, you know, 8 levels of sorcerer, and homebrewed in the world that sorcerers in this world were purely thematic. So this kid who's a sorcerer, this character is like a luck child where every single spell is only sort of entropomancy. It's only like, wow, you are so lucky. So like protection from projectiles isn't like an abjurative shield coming up. It's just the kid runs through a storm of bullets and doesn't get hit. And it's like, how did that happen? He has the grease spell, but we don't flavor it as a big thing of arcane grease. It's just like, man, your enemies were pursuing you and totally face planted. And they just were like fumbling Benny Hill cops, you know, like we just couldn't get it together.
It's a genre changing spell.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
Exactly. Right.
They thought they were in Game of Thrones, but no, yeah. it's something else.
The Yakety Sax starts playing, and it's like, you thought you were badass, but I'm afraid you're not. I'm so sorry.
Right. So sorry.
A whole different dimensional door where you just come in here and out here and over here.
Yeah. I love this right here, because like to me, I found this dichotomy between the optimizer and the storyteller kind of player as being set at odds with each other. And I'm like, I don't know that I've ever seen that person in real life. Like some of the people who are getting super involved in with their characters and wanting to portray them and role play them to the hilt very often try to like fine tune their mechanical expression.
You know? Okay. Yeah. Excuse me. While I Goldblum. I was that. I'm that player still to this day. So it's just, you know, you got to care.
I think 100%, that is my experience exactly. You know, people, there is a false dichotomy there. And I think that it's very, because the game has both components to it, there are some people that feel a need to justify why one half of the game appeals to them and maybe the other doesn't. And that's totally fine. But I don't think you need to go like well, the other half, here's why the other half is flawed. Because like you're saying, for myself, it's like, if you only like one, more power to you. That's totally fine. Some people like highway driving more than city driving or vice versa, but a car is made to do both. And you absolutely can, if you enjoy both halves of that, as I certainly do. I just did a one shot for Pat Rothfuss's World Builders charity, which was so, so fun. And I made a character that was completely like the genesis of the character was, well, this would be a fun thing to play, because it was a 20th level one shot, so it's like, oh, what goofy shenanigans can you get up to. And I made a 20th level sorcerer paladin, which is an incredibly effective combo. I did a one round drop of 280 points of damage.
Yeah, I bet you did. I bet you did.
Yeah, so it's completely goofy, but the race for the character was Warforged, which is not an optimized paladin thing particularly. I just thought it would be cool. So I think there's a lot of having your cake and eating it too, where it's like, if you want to get into crunch, is fun. It's fun to do a bunch of damage in one hit. It's also fun to make a weirdo. This the character was like a he was Oath of Ancients paladin and divine soul sorcerer, and he was Warforged. So he was very much like a sylvan iron giant, like a sort of druidic Warforged.
I feel that, like, yeah, yeah.
The forest had brought to life to like defend the wild places. Mm-hmm. I was just a big old sweetheart, you know, like a sort of druidic, mm-hmm. you know, construct. And it was very, mm-hmm. very fun to play.
Yeah. I think in this sense, fifth edition is like a step in that direction, whereas third edition, and I guess Pathfinder, I wasn't on board that train when it split off, but like that sort of a little bit of nods to mechanical tinkering, but a lot of like you what you can do with your character is a lot more open. You don't have to have an optimized combo in order to have the kind of character that you want. It's okay to not play at that top level, and yet the game isn't going to punish you for it, you know?
The game, I totally agree. The game has become a lot less brutal in punishing a non-optimized choice, you know? And I think second edition, the brutality was written in the text. It was like, oh, you can only get to this certain level if you didn't pick the right race class combo.
Yeah.
Like, Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah. And your stat rolls were lucky enough. And
yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, you can't even try. It's, you know, the entire point of fantasy is like fantasy. If you look at fantasy as coming kind of from the canon of Tolkien, where he's like, yes, even a very little hobbit can make a difference. And second edition was like, no, they can't. Yeah. They're too weak. And it's like, Jesus.
They have to be thieves.
They have to be thieves. Nothing else. And then going from that to 3.5, which didn't have in the text so much, but in kind of the negative space of the design, like 3.5 wasn't trying to be brutal, but by the time all the source books had come out, it's like, oh, sorry, you're not going to be an abjurant champion. You're not going to take full BAB progression and full spell casting. Do you, do you hate your character?
Why right. You just use the player's handbook, you know, that thing that you thought you needed. Right.
Yes, exactly. I think 5e comes around, and 5e, there definitely still is optimization there. Cause I think the game understands that some people are looking for the ability to like get that dopamine rush of like, mm-hmm. Made a good choice. I made a good strategic choice. But you are not completely punished for being like, hey, I'm just going to go purely off of flavor. And so I can still be helpful. I'm not complete. It's not like, you know, in 3.5, you could have two 10th level characters that were living in different worlds if you didn't design them correctly.
Yeah, oh, certainly. Yeah. Certainly.
Almost definitely. Especially like, I don't know about you, but I was the math nerd. I was the math guy at the table always. So when people were rolling damage, I would glance over and be like, it's 32. As they're like counting on their fingers. And so for me, it's always been optimization was always like a logic problem that you get to solve. Like, how I want to do the most of this. How do I do that? And you put these different rules in here and you build this thing. And definitely 5e, you don't necessarily have as many moving parts, but you do have some options that overlay very nicely. And it's still, it hits the dopamine button just enough for you know, a hardcore optimizer like I used to be.
Totally. I totally agree. And the nice thing too about 5, listen, I think 5e's design mechanically is there's a lot of satisfaction there because a lot of the optimization isn't completely viewable in a single encounter. I feel like in 3.5, you could watch one encounter and be like, oh, these two builds are... Whereas in 5e, it's often like a very optimized, with the exception of like a 20th level goof character like I made in this one shot. For the most part, it's like, oh, the optimization isn't going to ruin every single encounter in terms of imbalance. But like over a campaign, you can definitely make an optimized choice. The damage yield is different for one character versus another. But it's not going to ruin every single encounter through that imbalance, right?
Yeah. And I think that like it's left this space open for some players, at least, to have a bit more expressiveness in their characters and who they want to inhabit as they adventure in these fantasy worlds. And like, I go from crotchety old man that's like, there were four in the beginning and that's all you need now kind of moments to the let's go wild and there's no limits at all. And what I like is that freedom that fifth edition seems to have of like no limits at all, or at least significantly less, because a Warforged that's animated by a forest that's an Oath of Ancients paladin sounds awesome.
Yeah. You
know, sounds awesome.
It's very, that's the thing too, is I have definitely I think my fantastical sensibilities tend to run, you know, a lot more whims. Like I'm ready. I don't need to be right in the Tolkien pocket to get the high. I actually kind of like, you know, hey, let's get some airships in here. Let's get some war forts. Let's get weird. Like, I don't need every single nation to like occupy the exact same, like, you know, time period influence. If these people are a little bit more Renaissance and these people a little bit more Dark Ages, that's groovy to me. Mm-hmm. I think that there is like you're saying, here's an interesting question for you guys. Like, when you, there are definitely people who, as a philosophical stance, don't go towards optimization. And to those people, I say, you know, go in God's grace, tons of love. Like, if that's really true, that's awesome. There are some people, especially like new players, that mm-hmm. will, as a philosophical point, be like, I don't want an optimized character. But sometimes I will sense like, that is something you're saying during character creation, when the first combat comes around and you anecdotally, right. I had a player who back in 3.5, she made a paladin character and, you know, maxed out charisma, which is, you know, back in 3.5, I think paladins were still wisdom based actually, but maxed out charisma and was like, strength is only going to be an 11. And I was like, hey, I want to give you a heads up. This is not, and she was like, no, I just don't think my character's that strong. And I don't really care about the math of it. And I was like, groovy. Hell yeah, let's go. We got into the first combat and she was like not hitting anything. And she was like, what the hell? What's going on? And I was like, well, it's the, you know, here's, you know, sort of like a mechanic pulling up the hood and being like, here's your problem, right? And
there it is. Point at the 11.
Yeah. Right, point at the 11. And but what's interesting is the conversation that we had after that, it really made sense because she was like, well, this is a fantasy story. And in fantasy stories all the time, a hero would be outgunned, but I thought my character would have kind of like a heroic pluck to them. That's why I didn't want them to be strong. I don't want them to be a big hulking warrior. I wanted them to be the plucky hero. And I was like, hell yeah. I was like, you're not wrong at all. Unfortunately, with this game, there just is no pluck mechanic. There's not a pluck thing that you get to add to dice, really. So we need to figure out a way to strut. And I think that that is something that I would never tell someone uninterested in Crunch that they're wrong, but I would just point out like what the end result of this is going to be is you're going to get to combat and your character, if you have a vision of your character as being very competent, I'm telling you the dice are not going to help you.
Yeah. I've always taken those opportunities to say, let's make something custom together. Because to me, the DIY spirit of role-playing games is one of the main reasons I'm here. And so like, all right, you're not feeling what you want in the rule book, especially for a new player. I'm not about to just completely cut them off and be like, no, you've got to conform to this thing. I want to keep them as open to as many possibilities as they've got. We're going to make something custom so that they can go into combat with an 11 strength as a paladin and still feel heroic, still feel like they're overcoming odds. And like, it seems like, why wouldn't you do that? Like, well, I don't understand why you wouldn't. So anyway.
Yeah. Hell yeah. I love that. I think that is an incredibly good piece of advice for anyone running their game. It's why my little soapbox I get on all the time. One of the character classes I really miss from 3.5 was the poorly named but extremely cool class in the dungeoneering guide or something like that, which was the factotum.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, I loved that thing. Because the whole point of the factotum was it's basically the like, it's almost like the Indiana Jones archetype of like an intelligence-based non-magical hero of like, I'm a scrappy archaeologist or like I'm some kid with a map I found and I'm gonna figure it out. And it's like at random moments, you can burn what's called inspiration to add your intelligence modifier. It's the classic thing of like, I'm not a brawny, but I can see there's a chandelier. I'm gonna cut the rope and it's gonna fall down and you know, like,
yeah.
I loved that character archetype because it actually did a good job of like what you're saying, Jim, like making mechanical the idea of the scrappy, clever hero. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a very fun, it's fun to make a mechanic for a thing that is more rooted in that like storytelling trope.
Certainly, certainly. I think to speak on another dichotomy, that idea of like mechanics getting in the way of what you want to do or the story that you want to have unfold at your table is like, well, if they're getting in the way, then it's time to change them. Because the mechanics should support this thing you want to do. They should enable it. They shouldn't be necessary for it, but they certainly shouldn't like get in the way. That's an opportunity to fix this thing. And again, back to the DIY, like hack it apart, make it your own, you know?
Yeah. Add a little hack and slash of your own.
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely.
So I have a question. This is based, Brandon, on an interview of yours that I read, and it seemed like you were likening being a dungeon master to a genie. And that really stuck with me, especially as we're talking about like character expression and how players approach playing their character. Because one of the things I found challenging as I was, once I realized like that I wanted to be a DM for life, I was a lifer and I wanted to run the best game possible, was like meshing and making some sense out of what might be four or five very different viewpoints and wants out of a game. And so I'm curious how you've approached that, or, you know, how you handle it these days.
I totally agree. I got the bug and definitely was that thing of like, oh, I'm going to be doing this for a long time. And Lord knows people are hungry enough for DMs out there that if you push past 51% of your heart being there, people will be so happy to take you up on that. For sure, to the point where you're like, hey, if anyone else wants to run a game every once in a while, I'd be more than happy to. Please?
There are other games? What?
But to your point, the genie metaphor for me is this thing, because even in the terminology, like dungeon master, you're at the head of the table. There's this very hierarchical sort of station to it. But the vibe of being a DM isn't one versus many as like a ruler. I think it's one with many as like, I'm making dinner for everybody. It's an act of, it's very much an act of service. Like, I think the long-suffering DM, the put-upon DM being like, guys, please, we have to, the dungeon, I put so much time. It's right. That's the vibe that it's really, it really, so the reason a genie makes sense to me is it's that classic, it's that joke that like the Robin Williams genie in Aladdin makes of like ultimate cosmic power, itty bitty living space. Mm-hmm. Of like, yeah, I control the weather and your enemies. And if I so chose, I could drop 100 dragons on your party right now. But we all know I'm not going to, because I'm actually here to serve you. And in fact, I can't even really control where the narrative's gonna go, because you guys can just be like, we're going east. And I go, oh, pardon? You know, like, mm-hmm. You're going where?
Notes.
Yeah, throw notes go out the window, and you're like, to the east you see a confusing mist who knows. Something. It's a mystery.
We go in the mist anyway.
Ah, great. In the mist you find a wall with the calendar on it. Yeah. And you're like,
I brought a pickaxe.
Like, what do I see in the room right now? Right,
yes. Calendar has next week when we shall play.
That has happened to me more than once. And it's a moment as a dungeon master where I was like, I could see it happening. And I was like, I've prepped this. I've done this. I'm getting a clear signal. They're not interested in that. Mm-hmm. Which way do I go? And I'm just, for me personally, I'm glad that I went like, let's see where this leads. Like, I've always got this for later. I want to see what they want to do. And it's ended up in some of my best campaigns because the players were like super engaged and ready to drive the action.
I think that, yeah, I mean, like that is, you know, there's that meme that goes around, the Sam Smorkel meme. I don't know if you guys have seen that. The one about like, adventurers walk into a tavern, the DM is like, you see some patrons, there's a group of mercenaries in the corner, there's a goblin drinking at the bar, there's an old bartender, and you see in the corner, covered in eldritch runes, a necromancer with a string, and the PCs are like, what's that goblin's deal?
What's the goblin drinking? I want to get him. I got his next round.
Exactly. And they're like, what's the goblin's name? I introduced myself to the goblin. And you're like, Sam Smorkel is like the Tumblr post that went around.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, Sam Smorkel rules. We love Sam Smorkel. Because, and this is one of those things where I think technically you could call this metagaming, but it's not bad. It's just that your players actually can't help how intoxicating it is when they can tell that their actions are crafting the world in front of them. Where it's like, because that's the thing, is what the PCs don't realize is they are even if it's a completely classic game where the PCs are not inventing anything outside of their one hero, regardless, focus and attention is what PCs know they can do to world build, because they know that what they pay attention to gets described. So they go, what's that goblin's deal? And they watch and they go, we're actually building this goblin right now because we are putting you on the spot to build it. And that's intoxicating.
We actually talked about this in a recent video on just NPCs in general. And my theory is that it's quick, it's iconic. Weird goblin at a bar is better than and more memorable than the paragraph of descriptive text that you had maybe five words to get, you know, that they would land. Goblin at a bar is so much more evocative. And then I didn't account for the intoxication of it, which I feel as a player all the time, where I'm like, oh, is this, did you not want me to do this? Like, were you not ready for this? Let's see how far I can go.
Yeah. Nature abhors a vacuum. And when you don't describe something, the players are going to want you to.
Yeah.
It's like, no, this, I don't care about the box text, you know?
Yeah. I think it's very funny. Well, it's interesting. I think players there's two competing things going on, which is, number one, players are obsessed after the fact. It always feels like players are obsessed. Like, did you plan that? Was that planned? And they love it when it was planned, because they're like, oh, it feels somehow like it has more authority or meaning. If it was if you can deliver a twist, if PCs think they're being clever and they're like, we're going to go the back door that you weren't expecting. And they open the back door and you're like, your enemy is waiting there. And they're like, you know, right? They love that. But on the other hand too, when they can know that they're pushing you off the rails into improvising, it feels almost like going to a part of the carnival that you're not supposed to go. It's like, oh, we got back into like the employee quarters. Like, oh, it has that rush of like, we're somewhere we're not supposed to be. So I feel like both of those have their own different tantalizing
thing. Yeah, when the players get on the rides that they are not tall enough to get on, you know,
there you go.
It's the same thing.
I always found that blurring those lines between prep and improv as much as I could really helped me as a DM. Cause I'd be like, all right, I can't just pull everything off the top of my head if I don't have something, some kind of idea of what might be there. But if I have it set in stone, I'm going to be so rigid. So I just decided I would lie constantly to my players and never tell them, like, I just a poker face, like, yep, so that they would never knew what was on the fly, pre-planned stuff I came up with while they were talking about it, you know, kind of moments, because I'm trying to maintain the sanctity of this fictional place. You know, that was real important to me.
I think that's really true. I actually had a philosophical debate with a close friend of mine who was playing in a campaign of mine, and he's brilliant, brilliant guy. But he was very much like, was this planned? Like, did you plan this or did you improvise this? And because he was like, if it was planned, that makes it more meaningful. And I sort of said, like, I said, like, to kind of pull the curtain and kind of reveal the magician's tricks here, something that I made up at the table is still something I made up. And when I was doing session prep for this, I wasn't like in a golden throne wearing like my preparation crown. I was like in my boxers on the sofa eating cookies. Like that's your like golden authority here. It's like me last Friday being like, oh, maybe there's like a, you know, a Bulet or like an Ankeg behind this door. Okay. That's the golden authority we're putting on preparation and planning is like me being like, that'd be cool. Like,
right. Yeah.
This chicken nugget looks like a minotaur.
Yeah.
This
could be a minotaur forever. You know, they're not going to know I'm just using a bear. You
know? Yeah. I'm just using a strange creature with many eyes swats at you. And there's just the bear stat block behind the screen. Yeah.
Exactly.
No, of course.
I feel the same when I'm a player, and that's why I get so when I'm a player irritated by a DM who will reveal it to me, when I'm just like, you don't have to, please, like, let's maintain kayfabe here, right? Like, I gotta keep I'm trying to keep an illusion going in my mind. At the same time, I'm also that player, like you mentioned, where if the situation calls for it, like if it's an investigation or something where like detail and timing and the like really matter, I really appreciate when a DM goes out of their way to have some kind of consistency. You know, there's always going to need some flexibility, but like, oh, I thought there was a clue here and I looked and there was, because logic followed. That's also very satisfying, but
yeah. Improv with notes. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. And I think too, that there's a, obviously, and this sort of goes to the idea of there's a big competition between like sandbox versus railroad. And I think that like you obviously people, I think going too far in the railroad direction is like a very well-documented thing that people don't like. But I think you definitely can go too far towards the sandbox as well. Because the truth is that like our world right now is the definition of a sandbox. Like you can do whatever you want. You go off into the world. It's a full real world. It doesn't appear. I haven't really in my life experienced anything I would call a plot hook, you know, like that being said, there's a lot of stuff going on in the world. Yeah. That is very much like, it's not a, in other words, it's not a passive world. The world is incredibly active. And I think that's the key to like a lot of planning is if you're doing a sandbox, which is literally like the world is static and it's waiting for you as like a sort of Animal Crossing, you know, like it's like this, right. Like go out and you know, whatever you want to do. There's an element I think that is good about railroads, which is as a DM, even if you want total player agency and then to do whatever, it's still that thing of like, I'm dropping you into a world where it's, you know, 5 years after the end of this enormous arcane war, or like there's a rumor in the land of these strange riders collecting artifacts. You just throw something like that in there, not to be like, here is the plot hook, you have to do this, but to be like, I think players want to feel like heroes, and what heroes do is solve problems and help people. So it's that idea of like, if you're not throwing something at, like, I love a sandbox campaign. I want to have my decisions matter. But the thing I'm most interested in deciding is how to address the problems of the world I'm in.
Yeah. Yeah. It's why I always say, like, I don't want a setting that's a utopia. Yeah. Like there's nothing for me to do. And part of the fun of being a player character, of playing a character, is like seeing your impact on the world and getting to like have that kind of agency, because I don't always have it in my real life, but I can in a role-playing game. And so like being able to influence the world is important. And from a flip side, as a dungeon master, that's one of my number one priorities. But I also find like just throwing players into a setting that's, especially if it's super detailed, and then telling them make your own way here, is like, well, now you're not doing your job as a DM, which is to at least at the very least provide a compelling first adventure and see where it goes.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think that actually, so this is an interesting segue topic of like, I think part of there's this really murky area where, because we know that PCs are solely responsible for the actions of their characters, we know that DMs are responsible for the world building and the actions of the NPCs, where the kind of sea meets the sky on the horizon kind of place is the backstory of your player characters, which that's a very charged thing. And I think that some people are like more light on backstory. Some people are heavier on backstory. It's big. This is charged, man. This is controversial.
Hot takes.
If you look at, let's look at the sort of, you know, the canonical Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. Frodo is Bilbo's nephew. That's why the ring goes to him. Aragorn is the last of the Dunedain. All these people have their motivation for why they're doing what they're doing built into their backstory. And I think that if you look at the beginning of that story as a campaign, I think that if you aspire to the sandbox, if you aspire to true player agency, I am not like a video game engine with like predetermined cutscenes. I really want to honor y'all's choices.
Yeah.
I think that you still have to go in and be an active DM during character creation. This is my little soapbox. I mean, you have to go in and because if I think in order to do that moment, like you're talking about, Jim, of like, do whatever you want. I think that works if you've made sure that your player is not, you know, Gus with a sword, but rather like, hey, your character was raised, your mother and father were the heads of this Wizards Academy that got destroyed by this Duke or this church or this Merchants Guild or whatever. And you have this book and it's been closed your whole life, but in the past couple of weeks, it started to glow again.
Yeah.
You know, you do something like that. And then a character feels like, I know exactly what my deal is. And obviously it's a collaboration with the player.
Certainly, yeah.
But I think that like to get the feel of like in fantasy novels and movies and literature, the characters have to be the main characters. Like it had to be Frodo. No one else could be the ring bearer. And I think finding a way to do that in your D&D campaigns is often like the key to making that sandbox style of play really work.
Definitely. I was going to say, first off, you could be Guts with a sword and be pretty badass. You're a Berserk fan. But when it comes to that point you're making, I know one thing I've started doing in my campaigns is not only session zero, but like I usually create a custom questionnaire for that campaign where I ask them kind of pointed questions about that lead me to what style of play they would like, what kinds of adventures they would like, you know, when it comes to whether it's science fiction or fantasy, like what kind of science fiction movies do you like? So I know like what draws them, right? Yeah. If it's heady, you know, full of debate science fiction, then like, okay, well, they're going to have more social encounters and exploration of both the universe outside and within, things like that. And I think that DMs, if you adopt a questionnaire, it can help out a lot, I think.
Yeah, certainly can. I found myself earlier in my DMing career having a lot of characters who would show up in the campaigns with these big backstories. And I was like, in retrospect, my reaction was one of, you didn't wait for the world yet. Like we've made this world saving sort of prophesied hero, but maybe that's not appropriate. And it took me a long time to realize like that was a missed opportunity to sit down and like get some deep hooks in a player for like what's going to motivate them. And I find that very distant from my own motivations when I play, which is I want to play the game and whatever facilitates that, I'm fine. I'll play Gus the Fighter after four sessions, whatever. He's not just going to be Gus the Fighter, but like for the first one I'm there. So I've had to do a lot of learning and sort of like approaching this from a very different point of view of like, how do you get people involved who want to be involved from the beginning? And you can also plunk them down in a sandbox and let them have a linear adventure as well. You know, it's possible to do both.
I love that. And by the way, that is so like, I think you almost want, like, if I was at a table and someone had made the prophesied hero character, someone was like, I have the last gem. I was found on a doorstep by, a husband and wife that, you know, were amazed to have a child and they raised me, but I had a strange birthmark. You know, I'm going to play the dude. It's like, what's up? My name's Phil. I'm a brawler. I'm cynical, but I really like this prophesied hero. I'm just here to throw down for this. Like you want the Han Solo to the Luke, or you want the Chewie to the Han. You want that person who's like, I love that of like, I'm not, I'm like, if you have the idealist hero, have the hero's like, I don't give a hoot about these ideals. I just like this guy.
This guy's awesome.
This guy's awesome. And if this guy is here to overthrow the emperor, then you know I'm going to help out. Like,
yeah. Anything he wants to do is great. And besides, he brings me on adventurous situations. You know, like that's usually it for me.
Yeah.
I'm going to justify whatever I need to be here at the table. And so,
if you had his pancakes, I mean, seriously,
right? Right. Exactly. And so I find as a player that leaves me very open to molding who my character ends up being in accordance with the group. And so like one of my first priorities in that situation is to find another character that I might have a connection with and to do that as much as possible so that my character has an organic reason for being with these group of violent strangers, you know?
Yeah,
but, you know, so that they have that. But I like it to come out and play. So coming back to like rolling with the punches as a DM and but at the same, you know, fostering that player agency to do what they want, to drive the game how they want. I'm one of my constantly refined and evolving practices is like, where's the sweet spot of prep? Like, what's just in time prep? What's long term? You know, how is it most efficient? And so I'm kind of curious if you have some tips or best practices that you've discovered for that.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's so funny. My relationship to prep is very different now because the prep for Dimension 20 is so different for the prep from a home game. And it can be very hard after a week of like Rick Perry, who's our head set designer, props and minis designer, like working with Rick is incredible. But that's a level of like, when I prep a Dimension 20 campaign, I have to prep all 8-9 of our combats months before we even do the first session. You know what I mean? Like, it takes so long to build these unique. So that's level of prep where I need to, you know, in my home game style, I'm all improv, baby. I don't know what's behind that door until you open it. Let's go. But that's also less true for like the 11-year campaign than it is for others. Like sadly, I think it all depends on the campaign. For Dimension 20, I need to know, generally speaking, what their enemies are going to be, because I need to know who's going to be in the final combat before we even do the first session, right? So that's a level of like knowing my PCs and being able to guess what routes they go down. And then you have this weird relationship of prep to improv of like, okay, my PCs are going to try to cross a river. I have my 8 stepping stones, which are these combats. Mm-hmm. I need to be able to hurl these stones into the river in whatever direction they're jumping. So it's like, yes, their choices matter, but I know where they're going to end up, but where they're going to end up could be here or here, right? I know you're going to fight these 8, you know, hockey skeletons in a fantasy CVS, but that could happen after a harrowing role-playing episode, or it could happen after a goofy skill challenge. One or the other, we don't know. And it's going to totally change the tone of that battle, one or the other. That being said, because I, you know, Dimension 20 is very much like my job. If I'm doing like a home game where I'm like interested in the game to a bunch of new people, prep might happen in 30 minutes right before the session starts, just because I also know that during the process of character creation, yada, 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 like pulling a first session, I've done so many first sessions that I don't really need to plan them, right?
Yeah.
And then a third even thing is this like home campaign where we've been playing it for 11 and a half years. So my prep for that is almost all mechanical because, you know, even if we play for another year, another 2 years, I have 11 and a half years of loose ends to tie up. You know what I mean? Like, I know who the bad guys are. I know what these guys want to do. I know where we're at. Like the world, we're at the point where it's like we're just resolving the final act. And so it's all of this stuff is it literally writes itself, and it's just now the housekeeping.
You're looking at the end of what you, people usually see the beginning of, which is this campaign has taken off. It becomes self-sustaining. and will propel itself indefinitely, but at some point will come to an end. And I think that end is where a lot of DMs and groups, they never see that point. So it can look weird when you finally approach it.
Oh, I've been playing this game since I was 10 years old. I have, other than Dimension 20, which is a very different animal because it's, you know, a production. I have successfully concluded a single campaign, just the one. You know, like it was the one I played from like age 12 to age 17, got to 20th level. They beat all of the gods of the lower planes, and you know, that was it, right?
Yeah. I probably have less than three, and at least two of those ended in like true TPKs. Like last sessions, you know, sorry guys. You know, I guess we're done here. And then a partial TPK where everybody else agreed to surrender to the dragon and become their lifelong servant kind of thing.
Yeah, so gotta be careful going up against TPK. Dragons.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, it's a rare thing indeed to get to the end of a campaign.
For sure.
Yeah, but Brandon, just to go back to your point about the way you have to prepare for Dimension 20, I think it is something that DMs, a skill that DM should have, which is the, I think it's sometimes called the quantum encounter. Like you have this encounter prepared. They didn't go left. They went right. Some DMs will immediately put it to the right when it was left.
Yes.
But like, or you could just save it. Just save it. They'll get there. And, you know, as the game meanders along, they find their way to it. And I think that is something, as far as prep goes, like it's something I know that I've done, like when the players didn't use a thing and I spent like an hour going, well, I'm going to have this big bad and we'll have these henchmen and these mobs and they'll come in this wave and that wave. And then like, we never use it. Well, guess what? That's just going to leave that there for a few weeks. And now we're going to come back to it. It'll be on the pirate ship instead of the bar. You know?
Yes. Yes. I think that's absolutely right. I love, yes, Schrodinger's encounter, right?
Yes.
I love that.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
It's great. And I think too that you, like you're saying, the most flagrant of that would be the kind of like, whatever door you open, this is the monster behind it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that there are ways to do that that are a lot more respectful. One of the things about it is sort of this thing of like the first season of Dimension 20 was a high school for heroes adventuring academy, you know, and the genre we were very much in was actually kind of like a teen sleuth genre. It's very much like high school mystery solving, like someone's been kidnapped, you know, it's like we gotta, and with that, you suddenly realize like, oh, hold on. I can absolutely structure this so that I am always on my rails and I'm never pushing the PCs there, because these guys are teen detectives, basically. Mm-hmm. If I put battles at where the clues are, I know that's a slam dunk, because these guys aren't going to stop looking for clues, right? Mm-hmm. So like, it's the thing of that's a perfect marriage of railroad and sandbox, where it's where it's like, I don't have to pressure or goad or do that, you know, that shell game of like, ah, the encounter's over here. It's literally just like, as long as you guys mostly find these clues every other session, we know the combat's going to happen. That's groovy. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Was there a Nancy Drow in that teen sleuth?
There he goes.
Sorry.
I see sometimes, because my brain is poisoned by Dungeons and Dragons, and I go seeking out these questions and things online where it's like accusations that it's a railroad if you put a combat in the way of what the group wants to do. Like, it's like, well, I don't agree with that at all. It could be that the bad guys are there because they want to intercept you or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's any number of justifications in the world, but it's also one of those tricks as a DM that you use. That's just sort of, I want to do something, the group, you know, something that we're doing, the plot, the story, whatever you want to call it, is moving forward. My pieces of that are reacting. Yeah. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with like, this is the encounter I have when the goons show up. This is the encounter I have when you meet the lieutenant or whatever. The trick is, after decades of DMing, you just have those and you can like sort of be plunked down in any standard, you know, scenario and be like, I know what's going to happen because the skeletons in a crypt is a standard encounter I have in my mind, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think that makes total sense. The idea of, it's very funny for people to be like putting bad guy, putting an obstacle in between your heroes and what they want is railroading, when that is the most central piece of writing advice there has ever been. It's like, you put an obstacle in between the hero and their desired goal? What the hell is that? It's like,
right. Do we even want to roll dice?
Yeah, it's storytelling. What are you talking about? What are you talking about?
Otherwise, Frodo and them would have gone to the Eagles, flown over the volcano and dropped it, and the movie would have lasted 20 minutes.
Like, what should Tolkien have done? Like, put the Nazgul up on Weathertop and have the hobbits walking by, and the Nazgul are like, we're here, but we're totally optional. Don't feel a need to get stabbed by the Morgul blade. Like, no. what the hell? No, that's great. But I think also to your point, there's like, it is not railroading to, like, let's assume your PCs are playing heroes. They probably want to stop bad guys, and bad guys want to stop the people who are trying to stop them. That is completely realistic world building. So having your PCs be like, we're going to go wreck shop, and having a bunch of goons and henchmen and lieutenants be like, respectfully, no, we will fight you to stop you. And the reverse of that, of like, once your heroes are running around heroing, how scandalized are they, you know, really justified in being, if you're like, yeah, your enemies are sending powerful forces to stop you. They're like, why did bad guys just randomly show up? And it's like, I don't know, you've been collecting these 7 powerful orbs for a year and a half, they really want those orbs to, what's confusing about this, you know?
Like, there's something about like the world reacting to the players is signaling that the DM's going to do what they want to do no matter what. And I'm just like, that seems like basic DMing 101, which is the world reacts to the players.
Exactly. If you look at most trajectories of a group of heroes, like how, like at the rate of encounter and leveling, you know, I feel like most PCs shoot from first to something like 8th to 12th level in game in an amount of time. It's often like 6 months, 8 months, a year and a half.
Is there semester abroad in adventuring?
Yeah, like if you're really hardcore adventuring, you could shoot up a bunch of levels in like a few weeks. And can you imagine being some, you know, dark Death Knight character and being like, hey, do you remember when we went and raided that port town that had like the monastery and the sort of wizard academy and that mercenary order there? So a couple survivors of that just killed a young dragon like a couple days. You're like, what? Some randos?
They've been on that grind.
You're like, they're grinding, dude. I don't know what to tell you. You'd be like, God, this is horrible. Like, yeah, they just dropped one of your worst monsters, and you know, like a couple weeks ago they almost got completely trounced by a handful of goblins, and yesterday they dropped, you know, a 13th level cultist, and you're like, oh god, this is a huge
now that Death Knight's reevaluating their life choices, like, it took me centuries to become a Death Knight, you know.
What is going out and being like, all of you bandits, why can't you do this? And they're like, we're not classed PCs, we're NPCs, we just have a stat lock, there's not even a rubric for how we improve, and it's like, this is a nightmare. Now on, only PCs as lieutenants.
Back to third edition.
If you look at like sporting organizations as the bad guys, they have scouts that go out and look at the up-and-coming talent. They're like, oh, you're gonna want to watch this wizard coming out of the dock area. He's got a new form of magic nobody's ever seen before. It's like knuckleball magic or something.
Yeah, incredible. Go for it.
I was just gonna say, I find the next level of that is, instead of enemy like combats, is you throw the social encounters, the exploration encounters, like the next level of that to really, really get the PCs even more involved is like, what's your flaw? They send someone after you to deal with that. Mm-hmm. Like, they found this out about you, that you have these weak spots that aren't, you know, they can't get you in combat. Clearly you're just a force to be reckoned with, but you're still a person. And that like ups the game and sort of really elevates it, I found.
Yes, I love that. Especially like having those other things. The long running home game I have, the sort of the empire that they are staging a revolution against, is definitely, it's like they're incredibly wealthy and powerful, huge armies. They also have this thing called like the Royal Alchemists Guild, which are all these weird steampunky super soldier, like, well, you know, weird, like if someone tried to like systematize and make the like Henry Ford assembly line for Dr. Jekyll's and Mr. Hyde's, you know, like get them out there doing their stuff. But they also have this like diplomatic corps. And one of the things we've done a lot of in the campaign is setting up like, oh, like the diplomats of this empire are maybe the scariest part of them, that like they are really good at playing enemies off of each other. They are really good at staging situations using propaganda to make different factions see another revolutionary faction as their biggest enemy rather than the overarching empire. Mm-hmm. Like and that is very much a like you're saying, finding that weak spot of like, yeah, no one can mess with you magically, but what are you going to do about like the crown just bought up every major newspaper and now the public sentiment is like turning against you. What do you do about that? It's like,
Yeah. The look on your player's face when you tell them they can't just fight their way out of this one, that this is like the grand ball or the king's court, like they're going to have to find another way out of this sticky situation, is always a fun twist for some D&D players.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that is a wild one. And it's very fun too. And one of the things I've had to make myself okay with in this, especially, this is a sort of interesting piece of advice for DMs that do get to like high level play. Like I have these 19th level characters. And one thing that I've just had to make myself okay with is for the verisimilitude in the world, like they went to this airfield, this like skyship airfield of the empire. And I went like, okay, they used to find these trivial at like 12th level and now they're 19th. Do I really want to make this a, and so what I told them is I had a communication with them of like, guys, I'm not going to scale the world up to you. There are challenging encounters left in this world for you, very much so. Yeah. But is it going to be fun for you guys to just roll on through this airfield and just rock these guys? And all of them were like, we have spent 11 years grinding. We would love to rock some chumps and not even have it be close. That's great for us. Yeah. And I was like, cool, let's do that. And then we had the fun thing of doing a combat encounter where these guys are the Avengers and they're just mopping up some chumps. And they're like, God, this is rewarding for us, for it to be unquestionable. And there's still some, like, they took some hits, some damage happened. And they had to think tactically. But the fun thing was, it was like, you know, for the encounter design of that, it was like, you roll up on this airfield with incredible magic. You're undeniably powerful. Can you stop any enemy biplanes from taking off to warn nearby this? They have some messaging technology that you're not sure of. Can you locate that with magic and shut it down before anyone gets there? And for them, it was like, oh, the challenge was never, are we in danger of dying? We know we're not. But can we show exactly how slick we are? And that can be really rewarding for high level characters of that, like, you know, the thing you see in a superhero movie of the heroes having, you know, it's not the Thanos fight, it's the act one thing of like, we're bantering and kind of, you know, chill and we're laid back as we just nail this encounter. It's really rewarding for high level players.
Yeah, it's opening up Avengers 2, mopping up Hydra.
Exactly. Hydra, yes.
And it shows that like, not all stakes in combat need to be life or death.
Yes.
That there are combats where other things can be equally as important. And then that lets you build encounters for high level characters, because at some point you're just playing rocket tag and there's not that many beings that are more powerful in the universe before they got to start taking on gods, you know?
Truly, 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 truly. Yeah, I think those stakes are very interesting. And I think like when you're building those encounters out too, like you're saying, it's like, okay, you can't just hit them one-on-one. It is rocket tag at that point. So it's like, how many other factors can you throw into this encounter of things like, okay, yes, you're going to win this. Can you win it in a single round before this thing goes off? Can you do it under these circumstances with these negative things? Can you do it one hand tied behind your back? Right. And those kind of become the new challenges that are really
fun. Keeping this first level character alive.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, keeping civilians alive. That's big. That's big. That's a big market now. You can't have any destruction whatsoever.
Of cities, yeah, it's very good. And I find that attitude towards both, like, coming at the players in different ways, not just combat, but then when it is combat, it's not just life or death. There's other things at stake. Like, that's what opens the game up. And that's what turns, for me at least, D&D from this, like, it just does combat kind of hack and slash to, we're just playing in this world. And what happens is up to you guys. We'll look at the rules when we need it. Kind of experiences at the table.
Yeah, high level play. It's so bizarre to have gotten to the point where there's actually some stuff to learn there.
I was going to say, how many campaigns? I know you have this long running one that went up to 20. How many of all your D&D has gotten up to high level play? Since that seems to be a point of like conversation on, you know, is there enough support for high level play? But all the stats say that it never really gets that high. So, because for me, it's only been a couple of campaigns have actually achieved upper tier play.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone, you know, in 3.5 especially, there is this feeling of like, from like third to eighth level is this really fun window of like, I'm not a chump anymore, but I'm often very, very frightened. And you're like, that's a great place for kind of an adventurer to be. Campaign I finished got to 20th, so the one I ended when I was 17, that got to 20th level, which was absurd. But we were so kind of, even as like 15, 16, 17 year olds, kind of like goofy on the rules in some ways, that it was still fun. And it was sort of like, yeah, this is crazy. You cast a wish. Whoa, yeah. You know. the one I ran during college, which was sort of fantasy noir, it was called Storm City. That one got to 12th level. And even that one, it was 3.5, starts to really hockey stick. 12th starts to get goofy. Because by that time, also, all of me and my friends were, you know, 20, 21. So that was when we were like, oh, I can actually sit down and read this book and really, really crunch, right? Mm-hmm. That was the one where my brother, Griffin Johnston, had this character who, he had a wizard who just polymorphed into a 12-headed Hydra. And it's just like, oh, that's all she wrote, folks. Like, there you go. I'm going to make 12 grapple checks, and grappling at 3.5 is just broken to bits. And that's, that's all she wrote. And my buddy, Jack Covell, who is a lead designer for Heart Machine, great, great D&D player, who had at that point gotten all these source books and indices and other stuff like that. He made a character in that campaign who used Magic Jar and a prestige class combo to make a character that made these mannequin homunculi that he could port Magic Jar his body into, but then when he did that, he had full spell casting in these sawdust filled mannequins that he would just bloop, like Magic Jar into. So he would die, explode. When he got killed in that body, he would explode for like 15d10 damage and then shoot back into his body in his toy shop somewhere and port into another mannequin. He also made a character that there's some Fiend Folio prestige class called Fiend of Possession that could possess inanimate objects, but then he had another class that allowed him to grant magic weapon abilities to other things. So, you know, first fight, someone's like, I attack with my sword, I deal 28 points of damage, and he's like, I possess a nearby carriage and give it the brilliant weapon feature. I'm now a lightsaber wagon and I roll through a crowd of enemies. And it wasn't like he was 20th level, he was like 9th level. And you're like, what the hell?
They're playing two completely different games. I love the Magic Jar mannequin trick, because that's a D&D villain, right? Like, that's you only thought you fought the bad guy. There, you know, you get done with it and you go to search the body and it's stuffed straw in burlap sacks or something.
Yeah, like that's that. Some life model decoy shit.
I mean, there was literally a fight where they were hiding in the sewers under their enemy base, and there were a bunch of 12th level characters, but what they did was they just had a boat filled with these sawdust filled mannequins, and it was like, all right, you're up, buddy. And a mannequin would run in, fight, blow up. And the next mannequin animates. They're like, go. And it's just like this. And I was like, is this fun for you guys? Do you like this? Should I go? Do you just want to roll the, I'm going to get a snack. You guys tell me how the battle's going.
Here are the stats. Know,
I now see where the manic downward spiral of your CEO characters comes from. It's just like this one guy. You're just like, really? Is this in the rules?
Here's the problem. The put upon us of the DM is this, right? I'm the master of the cosmos, but really I'm just one of your friends. Maybe, especially like my friends, you know, that have been playing the game for as long as I have, you go there and you're like, I can't outwit one of you, let alone six of you. I'm doomed. What am I supposed to do?
Yeah. It literally takes me a week to figure out just to give you guys an hour's worth of stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to really bamboozle you with this enemy stat block that I found 3 days ago with your eighth level character that you've been playing for years and know every single optimization front and back. This is a really fair fight.
I know that feeling very well. but I think you're describing a moment when a D&D DM goes, I'm going to be a high level DM. Because I think it's a perfectly legitimate choice to go like, nope, this is where I get off. I'll see you guys again at first level. And just to kind of play that lower level game, which is in many cases superb. But like getting up to higher levels, teens, and then into approaching 20, like you are playing a different game. Like,
yes,
this is very different. And I don't know how many DMs are like super into that.
It's really hard. Well, there's two things that are sort of bizarre about it, right? Which there's different problems. There's the problem of how do I make a combat big enough? And that actually is solvable. It just becomes scary because, like you're saying, it's rocket tag. You have glass cannons on all side. Mm. You know, with the 11-year home game, people took different builds. And it's one of these funny things where there's one PC who has an armor class of often 40 plus, pushing 50 in 3.5, 19th level character.
Sounds about right, yeah.
You can't touch him, you can't grapple him, you can't look at him, you can't do, you know, it's like, but the problem that character has is his build is that he's this untouchable saint, you know, this like sort of divine soul, he has the saint template, you know. And what ends up happening a lot of the time is it's like, okay, you're untouchable, but now in this combat, can you actually save your friends who are all glass cannons? Like this character's damage output is unreal. He can get dropped for sure. Mm-hmm. And so that element of high level play is very challenging because it's like, you know, okay, we're gonna have another combat. Either you're all dead or this is over in 20 seconds, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the other part of high level play that's very challenging is the part of world verisimilitude, which is like, okay, let's say you're fighting an evil emperor. What's really stopping you from mind blanking everybody, scrying, teleport, lay down some ninth level spells on the capital, and that's it, right? And then also going like, do you guys really want to go like, build a home and do something? You're all 20th level. Isn't it kind of incumbent on you to solve? It's the Superman problem. Like, mm-hmm. Why are you resting? Go solve every single problem in the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Don't be an Elminster. Don't just go running around chasing tail across the multiverse. You got to fix this world's problems. Yeah. And so there's I think it's something that like either having a world that's flexible enough and open enough that when the characters get there, you can accommodate it, or like factoring it in from the beginning, like mm-hmm. wherever they go, whatever they do, there will be adventure. Like if mm-hmm. it's the emperor, then the next thing is that emperor's infernal patron, or you know, something like that. There's always a next big bad, and you might have to leave the material plane to go find them.
Definitely. Oh, come on, you got the whole planes out there, come on.
Right.
that's a very funny thing. We're all, when I'm making like stat blocks for these characters, I like, because of the way the different PCs sometimes have made their builds, the spread on armor class can be like 15 to 20 points, where it's like, well, one PC has a very respectable 23 armor class, and then this other guy's got a 45. So if I'm like to make a monster that is capable of hitting this guy, it has to be a monster that cannot miss this guy. Like, how do you do that, right? So it's a very funny thing of like, we're gonna compromise, the monster's got a plus, you know, a plus 30 to hit. Okay. So, you know, it's like a plus 27. So like, it can still miss you on a 2, but it needs to hit a 19 to hit you or something crazy like that.
Right. Oh, yeah. Man. Oh yeah. Balancing that out. Cause Pruitt was usually the combat optimized player, you know, and it was anything I can do or throw in here to challenge this guy is going to wipe the floor with everyone else. So figuring out ways to challenge them was very satisfying. Sometimes it was, your friends are in trouble. You, Mr. Combat, you need to get over there and save them. It's not all about you in the spotlight.
I usually tried.
It's true.
I tried.
Right. We are coming up on our time here, but I always feel bad. I don't like cutting short a conversation, but
yeah,
time exists. The real world is what it is. Brendan, where can we find you? What do you got going on? What's happening in your world?
What's happening in my world is this: new episodes of Dimension 20, which is College Humor's actual play show, every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific. Go over to dropout.tv and check us out. You get Dimension 20. It's an anthology. We play D&D 5e, but in wild, weird settings. The one that we have going right now is called The Unsleeping City. It's a D&D game set in a magical version of New York City. Hey, forget about it. We're questing here. We got that. We also have Adventuring Academy, which is our podcast where we talk about, theory and craft behind the game. We have Adventuring Party, which is our talk back about, you know, where the cast sort of shoots the breeze about what we're doing in the previous episode of the show. You can find me on Twitter at Brennan LM and on Instagram at Brennan Lee Mulligan. Hell yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Excellent. Pruitt, you want to take us out of here?
Most definitely, man. Well, Brendan, once again, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure having this chat. Really enjoyed it. I've watched the first probably 5 or 6 episodes of The Unsleeping City. So a lot of fun. It was a great opening, especially with the whole Santa thing. It's just candy cane zombies, the whole thing. It's a lot of fun. But yeah, well, everybody keep a lookout for Brendan out there in the world. It's an absolute pleasure as a DM. Y'all come back here next time here on WebDM, and we love you. Bye.